there's this, you know, this other rabbi got in here trying to convince me there's no Jewish conspiracy. Now, you know, the biggest proof that there is a Jewish conspiracy is that if you say there's a Jewish conspiracy, all these Jews come after you trying to tell you there's no Jewish conspiracy. There's no Jewish conspiracy.
Houston, we have a problem.
Hello and welcome. Today is Wednesday, the 7th of August, 2013, and you're listening to The Pseudoscientists, the official podcast of the Young Australian Skeptics. My name's Jack Scanlon, and joining me this week is Ted Jennett.
Hi guys, how are we going?
Well, I am going well. The empty room is not responding.
We're alone today.
So everyone else is pretty much busy for legitimate reasons. I'm not holding it against them. But very luckily, Ted, who has been on the show before, he's a good friend of the Young Australian Skeptics and the Pseudoscientists. He's doing stuff with Shelley Siegel, which you'll hear about later in the episode because we've got an interview with those two guys. It's more of a Jack briefly speaks and Ted and Shelley talk about lots of interesting things. But you'll hear about that later. They're doing an interesting graphic novel, graphic anthology thing about life in Jewish community in Melbourne. But we'll get to that a bit later. So what's been happening with your life, Ted?
Well,
other than the very interesting things that we'll talk about later.
I want to apologize to the listeners because I've contracted a bit of plague.
So not the actual plague.
I don't,
otherwise, well, I'd
kind
be
of
very,
plague
very
because
scared.
I've been violently ill. I went to work for a bit in Sydney and first day on the job and I was just sneezing violently. And then, not joking, a chair broke on my head.
Oh, and how did that work? Did someone throw a chair at you? Were you engaged in professional wrestling?
No, I wasn't engaged in any professional wrestling. But I had to move some stuff, and there was like the chair was in sort of two pieces, and I'd be able to explain this more eloquently, but chair on head, I'm struggling. But I was lifting it up to move it, and the sort of, how do I put this, the one half of the object sort of crashed, and I realized that they weren't very well connected, and then it landed on my cheek.
That's unfortunate. It's a slightly funny image, but I'm sorry about that.
I've started believing in homeopathy now.
It's like the people that get hit in the head and then start speaking a foreign language,
yeah,
sort of like that. But for strange beliefs. It'd be interesting if there was, I don't know if this is the case, if somebody did like go into a coma and came out like believing in psychic powers or something. Not necessarily that they have a reason to, it's just that suddenly like all their, maybe their critical faculties like just disappeared and they started believing everything they heard or something.
That's not implausible, is it?
No, I think, well, I don't know heaps about neuroscience, but I do know parts of the brain do, like the brain is reasonably segmented, so you know you can get a tumor in a certain part of your brain and not be able to speak.
Is it not the case that people who are under quite a lot of duress are more likely to observe patterns that don't exist?
I haven't heard that particularly. That doesn't sound like it's not, like it sounds like it could be the case.
I
don't know.
I was I think it was something on the SGU or maybe a blog, but I definitely remember.
Oh, it was on the internet, then it was definitely true.
Yeah, no, but it was from a legitimate, a good old-fashioned skeptic source, but something of that nature.
I wouldn't be surprised because I think a symptom of like paranoid belief, being quite stressed,
patterns,
and you know, you're going to see patterns that don't exist. I think that quite neatly segues into our Houston clip, which I picked out specifically for today, because you know, Ted and Shelley are talking about like Jewish communities and Jewish things, and you know, there's so many clips on YouTube of just people thinking that there's a giant Jewish conspiracy of they're ruling the world.
It's
and
terrible.
Can we get some sort of official confirmation that that's not the case, Ted? Or are you not at liberty to
like
say?
It's like my cousin says, if there's a Jewish conspiracy, I want in. No, you know, this is actually neatly ties into what I'm talking about. There's a very good graphic, I don't want to say novel because it's not a novel, it's like a documentary, but by the comic legend Will Eisner, you know, after whom the Eisner Awards are named, about the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a manufactured text by, I'm pretty sure, the last Tsar, which was designed to blame, to use the Jewish community in Russia as a scapegoat for the economic problems. And it's, you know, it purports to be a text written by Jews about the world domination plans.
Mm.
And it's been proven a forgery time and time and time again. And it's still published in countries, in papers around the world, obviously dubious sources, as evidence of a Jewish world conspiracy. And this book by Will Eisner, I think it's called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion or The Truth About, but he as himself researches and plots the history of it and explains, you know, how every time it's proven as a forgery, it just comes back in some terrible form or another.
Like the Turin Shroud in a way, but yeah, maybe perhaps more modern.
Oh, it's just, it's quite mental. I don't know what it is.
I don't know. Yeah, I, speaking as someone who really hasn't had a lot of, I guess, contact with any sort of Jewish community. And like, there are, like, it's interesting, like, because we've already recorded the interview. I know I'm breaking, like, the illusion, but
yeah,
come on. Like, do you really think that we just shipped Shelley into the studio, like, for however long and then sent her on her way? No, we plan things. So we're talking about, like, the fact that Balaclava is this sort of, not necessarily isolated, but, like, quite a concentrated community of Jewish people.
I think sometimes, and I'm saying sometimes to anyone who's listening, it's segregated psychologically, not physically, if that makes sense.
I guess so. Maybe in a cultural
way. In a cultural way. And even when it's not, there are certain boundaries that exist. And that exists in all communities, I guess. But I notice it because this is the one that I came from. I don't know. There's a group identity that comes from a history of trauma. It comes from reinforced traditions, even when you're not religious.
Hmm.
And I again, that's probably true of many, many different kinds of cultures. It's just interesting because it's bundled up with a religion as well, I suppose.
Yeah, fair enough. As I was saying about people who think that a Jewish conspiracy is real, there's just so many people on the internet who believe that. It's all tied up in pretty – I think somebody needs to map out, I think, conspiracy theories and see how they're all connected because, you know, you've got your World Trade Center conspiracies where you might have like the American government – is doing it. So the American government itself might be evil and is doing things.
But then the Jews are controlling the American government.
Yeah, so you can potentially have like a Jewish cabal like leading that. Or you could have some like shadowy bankers who could be linked to the Jewish people because, you know, the stereotype is that Jewish people like love money and control banks and stuff. And then you have maybe the shape-shifting aliens or lizard people, royal family, yeah. New World Order, Illuminati, like Masons. It's all connected, man. I think it's a fascinating area to study sociologically.
Is it not the case that people who believe in one kind of conspiracy believe in several?
I wouldn't be surprised because, you know, there might be a mentality or a mindset for people to do that. But I don't know if they're believing mutually incompatible conspiracy theories.
Oh, I swear people do. Sometimes.
Well, I'm sure some people do. But I find it fascinating looking at that from an alternative medicine perspective because I'm sure that some people believe in two or more alternative medicine traditions that just can't exist together. Like you can't have chi and like acupuncture stuff and energy flow coexisting with something like, I'm not sure. I'm trying to think of something because I guess there are very tenuous ways you can connect like homeopathy and stuff because, you know, homeopathy could be renewing your chi through vibrations of memories of molecules that have been in water.
I don't think practitioners are, to be honest, thinking about it too much.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's – yeah, I find that completely fascinating. But yeah, that's we talk more about Jewish stuff. We actually talk a little bit about Jewish conspiracies in the interview. But another thing I wanted to mention just at the top of the show is that, of course, this is episode 99. So the next episode is episode 100, which is kind of a big milestone because we count by the base 10 numbering system. Looking at it sort of from an objective perspective, it's not like a huge deal. But subjectively, 100 episodes.
Is that because we have 10 digits?
Yeah, I think we count by 10 because we have 10 digits on our hands anyway. It'd be interesting if we counted by base 20 because we have 10 toes as well. But yeah, 100 episodes, it's subjectively and culturally significant. We've roughly been going for about 4 years. Not really. It's been a little bit more
than
that.
Has it been that long?
Yeah, we started in December 2008.
So that was were you quite on the a while show ago. At the beginning?
I was. I wasn't on the very first episode. I think I've told this story before. I wasn't on the very first episode, but I was on the pilot episode and the second episode. I just couldn't make the first recording, so I've been there all along.
So when Ben and I used to do that segment,
yeah, I was there. I just may not have been on some of the episodes.
Exact same show, or maybe we recorded separately.
I don't know. I think you did record some of those separately.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so long ago.
Those days at Jason's house.
In South Yarra. But yeah, it's been 100 episodes, and we've got a live show in Carlton next Wednesday on August the 14th. So that's at Pug Mahone's in Carlton, the Irish pub, and that's at 7:30. Now, I haven't announced, at least not on the podcast, the most exciting thing, really, about this live podcast, and that's because we didn't really have it confirmed until just after the last episode came out. That is that Lawrence Leung is going to be our special guest. How awesome is that?
Lawrence Leung is actually the greatest person ever.
Yeah, he's if people don't know, and if you're from America, or maybe you're Australian, you haven't watched any Australian television in the past couple of years, or seen any comedy or anything. Lawrence is he's a comedian, he's a writer, he's made a lot of TV shows. His two most major ones are Lawrence Leung's Choose Your Own Adventure, which was, I think, in 2009. And then he had a show that was explicitly skeptical, and it was pretty much the focus of the program, called Unbelievable in 2011. And basically, it's like the dream sort of like skeptical show where he's making it accessible to people and funny. And he goes to TAM and speaks with like mentalists and James Randi and stuff. It's so good.
His talk at the Skeptics Convention here in Melbourne was fantastic. He talked a lot about the genre trope of the skeptic being always wrong and being the first one to die.
Mm. We might actually discuss that next week.
Yeah,
he's got so much stuff to talk about there, like blending skepticism with entertainment and how to get that message across.
But it's an almost necessary, you know, in horror films, there's always the person. I mean, this is quite the flip side of what he was describing, because he was talking more about disaster films and stuff. But
Samuel Jackson being eaten by a shark.
Well, excuse me, listeners. He was in horror films. You know, there's always the person who warns you not to go to the cabin or not to go to the haunted house, and the people say, "Ah, you're crazy," and then they go, and then they get brutally tortured and murdered. And I remember going the way thinking about it, and then for some reason I got really obsessed with Jor-El of Krypton, who was a climate scientist who was right, and the planet exploded. So that's a slightly different
variant. We'll be talking about superheroes perhaps a bit later.
I actually blogged about this.
Yeah.
Russell Crowe.
Yeah, well, I wasn't a huge fan of that.
I will find him! Sorry. Zod will find him. He's very serious about that.
So we've got the interview coming up, but I thought we might, like we did last week, we might inject some news in there into this episode, just because we need some sort of scientific stuff in this show every single episode. So I thought I might talk about this thing that we've actually talked about on the show before. Back in episode 41, we discussed what we called vat meat, or a lab-grown burger or meat. And this is a thing that has been going on for a number of years. People have been trying to grow meat in the lab. So this is quite, well, we'll get into the benefits later, but this is something that a lot of people have been trying to make happen for various reasons. And the reason that we're bringing this up again is that in London, a couple of days ago, it was actually eaten, like this burger that cost $300,000 to make. And it came from stem cells that they got from animal tissue, and then they grew it over time. They put little pellets together and stuff, and then they mashed it all into a burger, and chefs cooked it and ate it. And apparently, it's quite an acceptable burger. So this is fascinating to me, because I think I'm influenced by arguments to be vegetarian and vegan, and for really inexplicable reasons, I'm not a vegetarian or a vegan. And the stupid answer is that meat is delicious, but it really is. I don't know. It's not the rational approach. But if we could make meat without actually having to harm any animals, that would obviously be the preferable option. But there's also other benefits as well. So what do you have any – have you heard about vat meat?
Well, I have, and I'm very interested in the prospect of it, because – in terms of feeding the world and cloning meat for nutrition aspects and health, there's a lot of advantages in there. This isn't my field of expertise, but I understand that to be the case.
But would you eat meat that's been made?
I wouldn't have a problem.
Way?
I could certainly imagine. It'd be quite ironic if there were people who found that idea somehow more
disgusting.
Disgusting.
Yeah, that's what I'm always
thinking. Actual dead animals.
Because, you know, you're killing something and then eating it. And in a way, I mean, we've sort of evolved with that as a thing that we do. So it's not particularly weird on some sort of base level. But when you start to kind of think about it in the context of, like, humans are animals and, you know, and we're just eating things that aren't that particularly different from us evolutionarily, it starts to get a little weird. But I'm all for this. I would totally eat something that was grown in the lab. There's nothing wrong with it, unless it, you know, it was contaminated with some chemical. But, you know, there's always going to be that problem with any sort of food. So, you know, that's not something intrinsically troublesome about this.
It'd be interesting. The fringe groups, there would be vegetarians who wouldn't eat it on principle, even though it's VAT produced.
I wonder what the principle would be, because obviously there are vegetarians that are vegetarians because they don't like the taste of meat. But a lot of vegetarians are vegetarians because...
For ethical reasons.
And also, a lot of people are vegetarians for environmental reasons. So to create meat the traditional way through an animal... it uses a lot more land, it uses a lot more water, it uses a lot more energy. And in a world where these things are sort of going to become very important in the future as our population increases, finding a way to produce something that we sort of is a staple in our diet, I guess you could get everybody to become vegetarian through government intervention, through a fascist regime.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, that's just not going to happen. You can't force people to become vegetarian. So replacing this source of food that is potentially environmentally problematic with a version that is identical or very, very nearly identical but is way better, I think that's really the way to go technology.
And then humanity will look back and go, I can't believe we ever slaughtered that many animals.
I guess
in such horrible ways, especially, you know, in the way in which some animals are slaughtered today. And they'll also go, isn't it sad that it took us to have artificial meat before we stopped doing that?
I guess so, yeah. But
human psychology is very much
if there isn't a really good reason for me to stop doing something, I won't. But for people who are slightly skeptical of the benefits of this, of lab-grown meat, it only uses 55% of the energy that it takes. So that's a pretty big difference. But it's only 4% of the greenhouse gas emissions, which is pretty ridiculous, and only 1% of the land use.
And so, you don't have to feed the animal.
Yeah.
Because there's no animals. So
you have to feed the cells, but, you know, the problem with getting meat from animals is that to eat the animal, you have to feed the animal and up to that point where you can eat it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of energy goes into parts of the animal that we don't eat, at least in, you know, Australia. We don't tend to eat, like, I guess we do eat a lot of things. If you've ever eaten a meat pie, then you've probably eaten some pretty terrible animal parts. This is, it's a lot more efficient. It's like using insects as a source of protein, which I'm not entirely against. I'm not sure if I would, like, just crunch down an insect, but if they made it into some sort of paste that I can put in a sandwich, I would be totally fine with that.
You would, but I don't know about you personally, but there is a psychological hurdle. Or there will be for some people.
Yeah, but the thing with insects is I'm a bit of an insect apologist, but insects are not that weird, really. Like, we eat calamari and stuff, and they're mollusks. Like, some people probably eat calamari and they don't like snails. Taxonomically, they're very similar.
Why do so many people have, for example, is loathing towards spiders and things like
that? I'm not qualified to get into their psyche, but I just think they they look freaky. Or it's some sort of cultural thing where... they're just, you know, spiders are this freaky thing
We don't like spiders or snakes.
An evolutionary psychologist would say that's because, you know, these are dangerous things and we don't want to get near them.
I don't want to get near evolutionary psychology.
Yeah, it's not my favorite topic either. But, this is I'm really glad we're talking about this on the show, because this is something that I was really hoping that we'd follow up on. It only cost $330,000 to make this one burger, but it was just a proof of concept. So you can't, you know, as we put more money and effort into it, it's going to become more economical. And hopefully it'll reach a point where you can buy an artificial source of meat for the same price as a regular source, and hopefully people will start switching. I think it'll take some interesting advertising. And there's a show in Australia that hasn't come back this year, but I think it is coming back for the election. It's called Gruen Transfer. So American people probably won't know much about it, but Australian people are all just nodding their head at the moment. It's all about advertising and spin and PR and stuff. And I think it'd be a really interesting idea for a segment of their show where they get ad agencies to make ads about a particular topic, for them to look at lab meat and see if they can sell it to the public through an advertisement. I'd really be fascinated to see what they came up with.
Well, I hope it works out.
Yeah, I'm waiting with bated breath. I was going to make a pun, but I think Ted's a bit too sick to handle any puns at the moment.
I'm going to cook some burgers tonight. I feel like a steak.
So that's our news item for this episode, and I think we'll just jump straight into the interview with Shelley Siegel. She also sings a song at the end, so that's a good reason to stick around and listen to it. It's a fascinating discussion, and let's get into that right now. So I'm sitting down with Ted. He's still here, but we also have Shelley Siegel in the studio. It's interesting calling it a studio. We haven't been in a studio for a while, and when you were first on the show, Shelley, we didn't have a studio, and we were in your house recording an interview.
Yeah, we're just chilling on the couch.
Good old days.
Yeah, it's nice to see you in the studio.
Yeah, so if people don't know who you are, you're basically a singer, a songwriter. And the reason that we had you on the show 2 years ago, I think it was, nearly 2 years ago, you just released an album called An Atheist Album.
Yeah.
And now you're teaming up with Ted and a couple of other people to do a graphic novel.
We've gone and written a thing. It's going to be good.
What is it?
So I've written this comic book with Shelley and a couple of other people. It's called Balaclava Junction, and it's kind of a comic book documentary about true stories of people who grew up in Balaclava in Caulfield North in Melbourne, which is sort of the epicenter of the Jewish community. A lot of it came from growing up with the contradictions of being Jewish but not religious, realizing that religion doesn't kind of work out for me, and, you know, obviously Shelley was an interesting person to go to about that.
Who else is involved?
So first chapter is me, which is essentially a meta story writing about why I wanted to write the thing. And I can probably talk more about that later, though it's not nearly as interesting as writing about Shelley, because Shelley, I knew from meeting with the atheist convention a couple of years ago, had a great story coming from the same place that I did, which was the Jewish community in Balaclava and Caulfield North and the Jewish schools and the synagogues, et cetera, et cetera, and in a very public way come out and done her thing. The next person we've written about is a guy called Raphael Aaron, and he will seem certainly to this audience like a contradiction. He is the director of Cult Consulting Australia, which is an organization basically stages or assists in interventions to do with people who've fallen under the thrall of gurus or become involved in cults. So he is an exit counselor, which, you know, you can wiki that. Exit counseling is a model in which to extricate people from cults. He's the author of a bunch of books called Cults, Too Good to Be True, and Cults, Terror and Mind Control, as well as books about cult drugs and other interesting social problems. He's also an Orthodox Jew, and he's very religious, and that may seem like a contradiction to our audience. And I've read, you know, some of his books, and he writes about alternative medicine cults and psychics and a lot of things that skeptics find very captivating. The book doesn't really go into that contradiction. I'm not really interested in that from that point of view, because religious people do all sorts of things, but it may be interesting to this audience. And he's certainly a charismatic person. We do have a fourth chapter, and there's a number of possibilities as to what that's going to be. I don't want to say yet, because I want to be very secretive.
Keep it a secret? Yeah.
Yeah. It'll be different. It might be about a lot of people. It might be an experiment. It might be my emotional turmoil, you know, written in blood.
I think what's cool about the project is it's more a focus on the place. And when you were explaining to me, you know, at the beginning, what you wanted to get across with the book. It's like it's a documentary of this place, and you know, people kind of like anti-tourism. It's this place that you just drive by and not think is anything really special and important, but at the same time, it's this place that's really shaped the lives of the community that's been there. And what I like about it kind of is it's not just like we share a worldview, we're both atheists, we've met through the atheist movement, but it's not just about us and our experience. It's like it's about the context that that shaped our experiences, that led to our experiences, and not all the conclusions of all the participants are the same. And you know, whether or not we share a worldview with Raphael, you know, it's about the context from which we've all come. So I like that, and it's not just, you know, everybody's the same.
Well, yeah, I mean, I decided I wanted to do this in part because I've been working for film companies where you sit around waiting for gatekeepers to eventually come back to you 3 months later and say no. But I wanted to do something, obviously, just a DIY ethos, get it done. And then if someone wants to publish it after it's done, they can do it, but I wanted to do it. The other thing was I was traveling. I did my first sort of tourism thing, and you go and you do a place and you... you think, okay, now I've seen something and now I know about it. Actually, you learn stuff about places from going in the back ends and the corners and the things you don't expect. So I did kind of picture it as backwards tourism. The other thing is that as looking at all these stories and some of the people who I've talked to but aren't major stories in the text is that our lives kind of share common themes. Even if you're outside the Jewish community, if you're connected by a physical location and you're exposed to the same surroundings, certain ideas kind of recur and motifs occur in your lives.
So Shelley, what's your story particularly about? So it's about growing up in this Jewish community, but then also realizing that you don't share that perhaps belief system that everybody else does.
Yeah, I guess my story in the story is kind of my journey from being a believing Jew to being an atheist, and it kind of documents, like, we went through the my life story. We had a day with a whiteboard and, you know, we kind of picked up at the kind of milestones and the points where things really changed, and you know, what led me to become an atheist, and then what led me to secular activism and the conflicts with my family, and kind of placed it in the locations of Balaclava and North Caulfield as well, and then culminating with my music, which is the musical expression of my, I guess, atheist journey.
The other thing with writing Shelley's story was I was very conscious of making not an atheist polemic very specifically, but making a becoming an atheist story. I wanted to write it from the point of view of there are probably people out there who think that atheists, you know, they'll say godless as a pejorative, and that is not cool to me. It's unacceptable, and I wanted to show, to create empathy with Shelley, the character, all the way through becoming this person who was in no pejorative way an atheist, godless.
And like you were saying, some people think, oh, you're just being rebellious. But there was no point where I ever wanted to rebel.
Yeah.
It was like I kind of was forced to face the contradictions that I was experiencing and the, you know, dissonance in my own mind. It wasn't really a choice.
That's something that young people get when they have strong opinions. They're rebellious or they're abrasive, but it's not fair.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty important story or perspective to highlight, I think. Because, yeah, as you say, a lot of young people who might be, I guess, the instinctive word to go with is rebel, but maybe a better one would be to say that their resist has a bit of a violent connotation. But just, I don't know, not sharing a belief or sort of trying to, I don't know, get out from some sort of system that they don't feel a part of. Yeah, the temptation is to label that as rebellious behaviour, but that's definitely not the case. People... a lot of young people who are trying to get out of that sort of thing are not seeing it as like some sort of insidious thing. They're just saying this is what I believe and this is how I want to express it.
It's really interesting from a, like, you know, a skeptic's point of view, looking at a community like the Jewish community in North Caulfield, and you see there's a group of people who you know, you're you're raised with, you know, all the families in your street and your neighborhood, and you live in this very insular community, and you go to the same schools, and your ideas are never really challenged. So you have no reason to challenge them, because your teachers and your parents and your parents' friends and this whole community are kind of validating this narrative that you've been given. And I think it's interesting to look at communities like that and question, well, how do we get critical thinking to those children? How do we get them to learn critical thinking skills? And how do we get them to question, you know, whether they end up disagreeing or not? How do we at least give them the skills to question, so that their lifestyles can be a choice rather than something that's forced on them, rather than an indoctrination?
Mm.
Well, I think every community, and community in any sense, whether it's an online community or a community defined by a place or by ideas or an institution, is unique and has its own secret stories and has its own sort of history. But where we came from, it might be hard for people to understand. I know this isn't unusual, and there's different examples and there's similarities in other places, but Balaclava, Caulfield North, is literally branded with religious imagery on the streets everywhere you go. And that... It does things to a person. I'm not saying that it's good or it's bad or anything like that, but it does frame your thinking in a certain way. I don't think I would be as interested in religion if I wasn't exposed to it from such an early age. I think I would be able to shrug it off much easier if I hadn't seen it, if I hadn't been taught, you know. And I only went to a Jewish school for a certain amount of time, but I remember being interested in the stories, but at the same time going, hang on a minute, this doesn't feel right.
Yeah. So do you think being exposed to religion in quite a strong way all throughout your life sort of makes you feel it doesn't necessarily make you like it can make you positive or negative towards it, but it's going to make you feel something. Like, I think a lot of people in Australia tend not to grow up with a strong religious background. Yeah. I know I didn't really. My parents weren't religious at all. We had RE at primary school. That was pretty benign, and for some reason that didn't really make it much of an impact on me. I don't know, maybe it says something about the efficacy of RE. but yeah, I think a lot of people that grow up religious end up having quite strong views on it one way or another.
Especially if you grow up with Judaism, because there's a political component and there's a trauma component. And there's a, well, there is. No,
yeah, yeah, no. I mean, it's such a big part of your identity, and it's really, you know, that's fed into you, and it's an ancestry, it's a heritage, it's a culture, it's an identity, it's an ethnicity, you know.
Even if you're not religious, which is the irony of the thing. I'm pretty lucky, but I always knew I went to a religious school, and I always knew that I was different and that I wasn't religious, and already there was a contradiction. And I know, Shelley, you were surprised when your parents didn't want to keep kosher when you had a sort of... You were taught to value your religion in a way, but they didn't want
to. Yeah, I
tried
to kind of become more religious.
Yeah.
We were kind of, you know, traditional, almost liberal Jews, and then I learnt more about it and wanted to get more involved and was surprised when...
They resisted.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know for some reason that you're supposed to have certain political beliefs. A Jewish person won't be asked, do you have an opinion on Middle East politics? They'll be asked, what is your opinion?
Mm.
Whereas... There are plenty of political conflicts in the world that I don't have an opinion on.
I think that's also something that, you know, is interesting from a being, you know, skeptical perspective. Like, part of, I feel, our indoctrination as kids, aside from, you know, valuing Judaism and Judaism being part of your identity, was a perspective, like you're saying, on Israel. And Israel is your land, it's your homeland. I was part of a Jewish youth group called Habonim, where it was a Zionist socialist youth group where I learned about Israel and taught other Jewish children about Israel. And it's fascinating that so many of, you know, my friends who grew up in this relatively privileged, you know, existence. We live in Australia. We don't have conflicts. There's a certain wealth and there's a certain comfortableness that a good opportunity for education and employment, all these things. And yet we were so fascinated with a conflict on the other side of the world that has nothing to do with us, to the extent that many of my friends that I was at this youth movement with actually have moved to Israel and now in the Israeli army and fighting for this battle. They're so convinced by this narrative that it's part of our heritage that they have, been moved enough to go to a Middle Eastern war zone and fight.
And to be clear, that's not about taking sides. It's just that it seems strange that we are raised to be so invested in any one conflict. It's not about it's about having a predisposition before you can understand the politics. It's about being 8 and having some very severe political views.
And since I've tried to be skeptical about the narrative that I've been given about Israel, I find that comes in the Jewish community with more opposition than even my atheism. Like when I talk about my atheism, people are, okay, that's fine, you know, there's another argument there, like, oh, whether you're still Jewish or not. but yeah, I find that criticizing Israel is met with more opposition than just criticizing Judaism as a religion.
Because that seems to be a major distinction between, I guess, the various forms of Christianity. I guess you can't say that Judaism is just one thing. It's like Christianity. It has a lot of different aspects and different branches. But the main difference between Christianity and Judaism is that Judaism does have this other sort of, historical and cultural aspect than Christianity.
It's strange. And anti-Semitism is quite different from other prejudices against people because it's a paranoid kind, where you assume there's a conspiracy. If you don't like another group, it's usually because they're taking your jobs or they're stupid or they're incompetent. Whereas a lot of people don't like Jews because they think that they're trying to they're behind the curtains taking over the world, which is they were behind 9/11.
Here's a question that has, I don't know, maybe not to do with our comic, but what do you think? Do you think there are parallels and differences between, like, say, anti-Semitism and Islamophobia? If you're criticizing Judaism or Islam, sometimes your criticisms can be dismissed by accusation of anti-Semitism or Islamophobia. So saying you're not attacking the ideas, you're attacking the people, and you hate the people. So it can be used in that dismissive way, or can be dismissed in that way.
Well, I think you need to be very clear about religious texts versus religion, how it's expressed through different groups of people, because every single religious text in the world, you can find offensive things in it, and no one can realistically deny that. But religion expresses itself in different ways, and what I would usually call humanism expressed through religion is what a lot of people think of as religion. So anti-Semitism or Islamophobia, no one should hate Muslims or Jews, but there's things offensive in all of those religious texts, and picking on those texts is fair game as far as I'm concerned.
I think it's an open sort of dialogue about how, especially I guess in the atheist community, about how to have some sort of criticism against ideas that people have versus criticism of the people themselves. So you might get a lot of people that may implicitly believe something that their religion tells them but not act on it or like seriously consider what they're believing. And I think, I guess there's probably some subsection of the atheist community that is just going to go after them no matter what. But then there's another subsection that would just be like, well, we should probably just focus on the ideas themselves rather than the people. And I think that has been a prominent criticism of quote-unquote new atheism or modern atheism where, that some people are just going after a group for what feels like unjustified reasons.
I don't think they are. I think it sounds like they are.
I think
some people are, but that I think, with any group, you're going to have that.
Everyone thinks racism and hatred and
us and them kind of mentality is going to be part of any community. It's going to be a minority, and hopefully among them, a group that considers themselves skeptical, it's an even smaller minority, but it still exists.
But I think, I can imagine the atheist in the corner who's never met a religious person and assumes that every religious person is Pat Robertson, and they don't understand that religious people are nuanced and they come in different forms, and they probably don't believe everything it says in their book, or they're not aware of it, or they explain it away, or they focus on the good bits, and that's just the way it is. Everyone thinks that Sam Harris hates Muslims, and he gets misquoted and taken out of context and just brutalized in other media, but if you read him carefully, it's just not the case, I would submit. I was imagining, and I was just talking to Shelley about this when I was writing her story, I was imagining what would a religious person reading her story take from it, and I wanted to, I wanted them to be able to understand, okay, I may never arrive at that same conclusion, but I understand why you got there, and I don't want to demonize you.
So this graphic anthology is being funded through crowdfunding, which is, I was going to say, a trendy thing to do, but that sounds a bit derisive. But it is, it's a legitimate way that people are publishing things. And so you wanted to go that independent route, and you're...
Are you calling me amateur, Jack?
No, I'm not. No, a lot of... That's actually a very interesting point, because a lot of non-amateur things have been crowdfunded recently, like major films. And like significantly really quite famous and prominent people have done crowdfunding.
I am so excited for Veronica Mars.
Yeah.
Veronica Mars is going to be the greatest thing in the world. And if anyone disagrees with me,
tell them to watch Veronica Mars, probably.
Yeah.
Okay. To be honest, I've never watched it, so I can't really comment. But I've heard good things.
yeah.
So that campaign is launching probably today, if you're listening to it.
As this podcast goes up. So this is what you have to do right now, listeners. You need to go to www.facebook.com/Balaclava Junction. And you can find us on Twitter at Balaclava Junct, BALACLAVA Junct, JUNCT. And the Indiegogo page, you can search for Balaclava Junction, and you will find us there. And for $5 American, you can order a digital copy of the text. And as you go up, you can get lots of awesome prizes and rewards. And there's even a Lost Tales book. There's going to be a few little short stories from Balaclava that are about maybe some lesser-known people, some stranger people, some cartoony friends of mine. Just whatever's interesting and ironic, that may be things that would be forgotten, but they're not, because I wrote them down at the expense of other people. So you should look into that. You can also help by telling all your friends, because your friends need me in their lives. they need us. They need myself and Shelley and Taffy and the rest of this community. And if they don't have us, they'll have this terrible, terrible emptiness in their hearts.
It's a good threat. I think
Balaclava Junction shaped hole.
Yes. It's a big hole.
Balaclava Junction is actually a place, corner of Hawthorne and Balaclava Roads. It's the only surviving Grand Union in the Southern Hemisphere, which means that all trams can go anyway from anyway. So it's like a metaphor for something. Okay. But it's also a place where the first story starts, and it's a place where I spent a lot of time writing this. And there's a coffee shop there, and those guys know who they are.
And they're listening.
I'm going to get a giant latte tomorrow.
Anyway. I'm sure all our listeners will check out the crowdfunding page. Chip in some stuff. It sounds like a great project. I've seen a little bit from it. It's very exciting. And we'll have all those links up on the blog, up on the blog post for this episode. And Shelley, you've been doing lots of music stuff. Last time you were on the podcast talking about your album that was 2 years ago. Obviously, you've been doing more music stuff. So you've got a new album that's come out.
Yeah. Since we spoke, I've released an atheist album in the UK and in America, and I've been touring extensively and speaking at various skeptics, atheists, and secular conferences a lot in the US, and learning more about the movement over there, which has been really fascinating. Then this year I released a new record. It's a collaborative album with a guitarist from the US. Adam Levy is his name. He's played guitar for Norah Jones and Tracy Chapman and Annie DeFranco.
When I found out that he played for Annie DeFranco, I went mental.
Yeah, you went mental. I went pretty mental when he told me.
Because I've just been listening to all of her albums, like, nonstop. There's a certain holiness there.
Yeah, she's easily my favourite artist. She's a really incredible songwriter that puts her politics into music, so it's a really big inspiration to me. So we wrote an album together, Adam and I, and it's called Little March. And the title track, Little March, is actually about a Romanian festival called the Marțișor, which translates directly into Little March, and it's about the beginning of spring, and it's this kind of ritual where everybody's giving each other these little brooches, and it has all this symbolism. And it was interesting to me because I was brought up in this Jewish community where ritual and shared experience is a really big part of our culture, and it's a really big part of my upbringing. It's always been something that's very moving to me. Like, even my introduction to music and religion were kind of combined. It was performing at in my father's Jewish wedding band. It functions bar mitzvahs and weddings. So you're using, you're kind of mixing music and religion and customs and rituals into this kind of transcendent, transformative experience. And so I wrote the song about this Romanian ritual, but it's kind of a discussion on ritual in a broader way. And I think probably because of my upbringing and this connection that I have to that kind of shared experience, I'm not so willing to dismiss it straight away. I think it can't be done just for, you know, for repetition's sake. If it's done in this way, we do this together because this is what our father's done and our mothers did and them before them and before them, you know, for the sake of it in a non-skeptical way, then I think that has the capacity to be really harmful. But if we utilize this obvious capacity that we have for transcendent, transforming shared experiences, we can use them for something really positive and something really good, you know, even if it's going to book club or going to a gig, you know, or doing a podcast every week. It's ritualized and it's you know, can connect us to the past. It can help us with a sense of meaning. It can help us with a direction for the future. And I've been experiencing that in the US with my shows that I'm doing. You know, I'm hanging out with groups who are politically active and engaged, and they meet every week and they have this same kind of ritualized experience. So that song's kind of interesting from that perspective.
So you've got your guitar in the studio. What song are you going to be performing for us?
After that intro, I should probably play a little much, but I'm not. I'm going to play a song called My Morality, which isn't recorded anywhere yet, but hopefully will be on my next album. And this came out of a discussion that I have quite often with people who, you know, maybe don't understand an atheistic or naturalistic worldview. And they say, how do you know how to be a good person without God? And how do you know the difference between right and wrong? How can you be moral without an absolute guide to tell you? So this is my answer to that, and it's called My Morality. My morality has nothing to do with the Bible or the verses of the Quran. My morality won't judge you by your spirituality, but by the things that you have done. My morality is not set into stone tablets. Don't even tell you not to hurt children. My morality is not dictated by a deity. It's developed from empathy, dependence, and love. My morality accepts everybody's sexuality, is more concerned with inequality than validations from above. My morality is not set into stone tablets. Who don't even tell you that it's worthwhile to be good, for being good's own sake. That not to think for yourself can be a deadly mistake. My morality is not recitable from memory. It's something inside of me, how I wanna be. Treat others how I want them to treat me. Basically, not to hurt anybody or pause any brutality.
reality. It stems from our common humanity. And it's what my mother taught to me. And it's mine because I'm free.
That was great. Thank you so much
for
that.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. What a good interview. Ted's still here, so don't worry about that. I said before that we recorded that earlier, so, you know, it's not a surprise that Ted's still here. Hi, Ted. How are you going?
We've broken the...
Still alive.
I was going to say the fourth wall, but that doesn't really...
There's no walls here.
What's the audio equivalent of the fourth wall?
There isn't one. So. We demolished it long ago. This show thrives on the standing on the remains in the rubble of the fourth wall.
Yeah, there's a demolition unit outside.
It'd be worse if we were an actual radio show, but we're not. You consciously downloaded this podcast onto whatever device you're listening to, so you know what you're getting.
Because we're pushing the boundaries.
The boundaries of audio. Right. And now I'm going to make a noise like a jet plane, and you'll be like, whoa, what's happening? I'm not going to do that. I'm not a person in a police academy. So in a regular episode, we'd probably jump into Jargonauts now, but because that interview went for a little longer than usual, we're just going to skip it. I hope you don't mind, because we've actually got a really fascinating question of the week that we asked people last week, and that was, which superhero is the least scientifically realistic? Now, this was a question that I guess I didn't really plan for it to go out this way, but, we're talking about it now on an episode with Ted on it, and you're, like, super into superheroes. You have, and comics and stuff, you have opinions about this.
Well, I have opinions about the... I don't think I'm so interested in who's the most scientific superhero. I'm more interested in... Does it matter? And well, are people caring? Yeah.
That is a legitimate question.
I like superheroes. I'm more, generally speaking, I probably like genre fiction. You know, I like my fantasy and my science fiction and all that stuff. Superheroes, I'm a little bit sick of, to be honest. I mean, it's a little bit enough. Like,
in terms of films,
in terms of everything. Like, I'm sure that, you know, there will be a good Batman story coming out at some point, but I just don't care anymore. I want to see something else. That's great, and it is really, really good. And some of the films that are coming out are quite interesting and doing different things. But I wrote a comic book consciously that wasn't superheroes or zombies for a reason. Even though I love those things, I really, really do. But on that point of superheroes and science, everyone was carrying on about Christopher Nolan's Batman films as being quote-unquote realistic. That's...
Well, they're slightly more realistic,
slightly more realistic, but genre is genre is genre. Realism is not the default position for a story. Realism is a genre convention. So when you watch The Wire, they've made it realistic to communicate something. When you watch... I don't know, when you watch Spartacus, okay, they've made it silly because that's the style. I don't think that Julius Caesar was running around in a slave camp with swords, but...
you've just ruined the illusion. I'm never going to watch that show, but, you know, you've completely destroyed any interest that
you know,
I had.
People think it's like when you go to watch a musical, people don't actually sing.
Oh, people sing all the time, mostly in the shower.
Yeah, but they don't burst into a song. And I think that people who go into something thinking that it's realistic are deluding themselves. The thing about Christopher Nolan's Batman films is they don't need to be any more fantastical than they are.
Mm.
If that Batman was existing in the Justice League universe, you can make it sillier and make it more extreme and do all that stuff. But because it's its own thing and it doesn't need to be, let's just have him defy the laws of gravity and have slightly futuristic technology from time to time, and make, you know, the biggest problem for me in those films was the third film where, and actually I really want to have a public opportunity to say this, but when Bruce, okay, spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen The Dark Knight Rises, but when Bruce is in that pit and he has to take a leap of faith in order to jump out, that's the only way that he can escape. That's me inside the plot holes of the film. If I want to enjoy the film, I have to take a leap of faith and jump out, because what was, you know, this really grounded, psychological, you know, dense thematic work for a superhero genre saga, you then have Bane doing the Saturday morning cartoon thing. And I'm talking about bad Saturday morning cartoons, not like Bruce Timm Saturday morning cartoons, where Bane goes, "Don't kill him now." Well, why not? This is the second time you've said that. You know, first you take him to a prison that he can escape from, where he's obviously being nourished enough to retrain himself back to health, and his leg was really injured beforehand, and he had this fancy gadget which made him all fine. He obviously doesn't have that in the prison, but he just does some push-ups in it. It doesn't make sense. That bothers me more. That kind of plotting bothers me more because it breaks its own rules and its own internal logic more than no one's ever answered, I don't believe, and I've looked this up and maybe I'm wrong, in DC Comics, why Kryptonians look human.
Very interesting. That is a running thing in science fiction, though, where
aliens are human.
Obviously, in the early days of science fiction television, like Doctor Who and Star Trek and stuff, you just couldn't get away with non-humanoid aliens because, you know, you need to have people that are actually actors, and there's only so much the props department can do to make you look less human. And, you know, you don't want people going around as, like, sentient trees and stuff. So, you know, they were just people with things on their faces.
But who cares? I mean, it's a story. You just disappear on the thing, and then it's the characters, the emotions, and the humanity of it that matters. Even if you're writing about aliens, you're actually writing about humans.
You know? Unless the point of the science fiction, it's probably more of a sci-fi novel thing to maybe make the aliens completely alien. And there's a lot of interesting sci-fi out there around those ideas. But to get back to the question particularly about unrealistic superheroes in terms of science, I thought we might just go through some of the opinions of the audience, because that's the point of the segment. You don't listen to this segment just to, you know, hear us speak, even though we are
just to hear me vent. Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm all for venting. It's just that people are going to get annoyed if they don't hear their opinions.
Let's hear
they're a very needy bunch.
Oh, that's good.
Now I've just offended everybody. I don't know how much you know about, like, Marvel stuff, but Jake says, wouldn't the most scientifically unrealistic heroes just be the ones who admit they're powered by magic, like Captain Marvel, Doctor Fate, or Doctor Strange? But if we're sticking to the least plausible ones who attempt to look sciencey-ish with some hand-wavium, then it's clearly Superman. And Luke has also said Superman. So Superman was a very common choice. So what are the powers that Superman has? He can fly. He's got the heat vision, ice breath. He can somehow survive in space. He's got other things going on for him. Super strength. What's, like, from a scientific perspective, that's all supposed to be explained through the fact that he's an alien, but he has, like, this thing that's going on with Earth's sun. And it's giving him superpowers, but in a scientific way.
There's a thing about gravity and density of atmosphere on Krypton being different.
And which so makes no sense, because just because it's less gravity doesn't mean you can fly.
Well, interestingly, and I'm nearly 100% certain, I just don't want angry emails, but pretty sure the very, very first Superman could only leap very
quickly. Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah. Like Golden Age Superman. He was actually a lot more realistic. He was just a really strong guy. And he could, I guess, jump far, which is slightly unrealistic. But more realistic than flying, because, you know, how is he flying? What is the mechanism? I don't think that's ever been explained.
There was some documentary called The Science of Superman, but it's all, you know, post hoc reasoning.
Well, it could be crystals in his eyes that are refracting the lightness. Yeah. Yes, like, that's not going to happen. Will has said the Green Lantern... So green, for people who don't know, the Green Lantern's powers is basically, I guess it's slightly,
yeah, it's
slightly interesting
ring.
That Will would say it, but he has like a green ring and he can use willpower and stuff
to make
anything, which I guess you could futurize and technologize that by saying that it's some sort of 3D printer using energy, but I don't know, I guess it is an alien technology. Which is not particularly completely unrealistic. As Claire said, Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen, and he has like vaguely sciencey superpowers and stuff, vaguely. But I don't know. All I've done is watch the film. Unfortunately, I haven't read the graphic novel, and I should be probably
lashed. There's a very angry bearded man who wants to come and kill you.
Hopefully, not kill me. That's a bit harsh. Bearded man, sit down.
He's quite spiteful.
You know, they announced that someone's making a TV pilot of The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Oh, really? Wasn't that a show?
Yeah, that film, the reason he no longer accepts money for the films that are made adapted to his work. Because who are you speaking of? Alan Moore.
Oh, okay.
But he's always got something to say. I'm pretty sure with regarding the Watchmen movie, he said he's spitting venom on the project.
Ah.
So, yeah, not happy.
Nice. So, yeah, to you, Ted, what would be the most scientifically unrealistic superhero? I guess Superman's an obvious choice. Is there anyone that we haven't mentioned yet? Any of the X-Men? I guess, yeah. For me, while you have a bit of a think, I guess the X-Men, I just have to say it because I'm a genetics person. And because the X-Men is trying, I guess the point of the X-Men from like a comics perspective and from a social commentary perspective, it's all about minorities and stuff. And so they're not necessarily focusing too much on the science. But, you know, the movies and I guess the comics as well do try and justify these powers by saying that they're mutants of a particular gene. And it's like the gene X or something. Mutating one gene is not going to give you all these powers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just have to say that. I know it's you have to take it with a grain of salt. It's all fantasy stuff anyway, but you know.
The X-Men was a pretty interesting like allegory for minorities and social problems. I think
I'm not going to say the point of the comics and the movies, but that's like the message. It's the moral, really.
Particularly in the films, it bothers me because it's just, why can't they just be five different kinds of superpowers? Why does everyone have to do some weird thing?
Yeah, why does everyone have a different thing? That's kind of interesting. I don't know how a mutation in a single gene could cause you to turn into metal. And if someone finds that mutation, can you please let me know? Because I'd be very interested in turning into metal.
I don't know. I can't speak to the most unscientific superhero, but I can certainly say there are some really bizarre ones. And an interesting one, and I still think this could be made into, there could be some good comics written about this, and there could be a good film or whatever. Aquaman's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Because, Atlantis, which we skeptics know all about.
Oh, it's real, and it is coming back. They are taking their revenge on the mainland as we speak.
Yeah. Well, Atlantis is an underwater civilization, and Aquaman is the king in various incarnations or of some form. I'm not too okay with it.
Yeah, and why is he called Aquaman if he's the king? King Aquaman, just, I don't like that ring.
Well, he goes by a different name. I don't know these things, but
obviously, I'm completely ignorant of Aquaman, but it's Aquaman. He's hilarious.
Yeah, everyone always... It's pretty cool because it's just this different world and it's all mental. Like, why not? I mean, you could do...
It's, talk to dolphins.
Well, honestly, I mean, you could do something really interesting. It would, completely otherworldly, but why not? It's not actually that stupid. I think Green Lantern is more boring.
Oh, probably. It depends. I think any superhero can be interesting. It just depends how you tell the story, really.
Remember that Iron Man was not a Spider-Man. Before the films, if that makes sense. Iron Man wasn't huge.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he was huge, but not huge like Spider-Man, Batman, Superman.
Mm.
He was like just...
Thor, maybe?
Yeah, and the fact that they launched the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Iron Man was a really big deal because I don't think, and I could be wrong, and but I have a suspicion that Thor or Captain America wouldn't have kicked it off quite as well, and The Incredible Hulk certainly didn't.
Yeah, well, that wasn't a really... It was kind of a proper Marvel movie, but it was quickly retconned with a quick Edward Norton film. So that was sort of taken out of canon.
Which one?
So, you know, you got the Ang Lee Hulk.
Oh, yeah, but that one was... That's denied. No one acknowledges that exists.
Yeah, nobody thinks that exists. Yeah. Poor Eric Banner.
That was interesting because it failed in a different way than other superhero films.
I haven't watched that, I think. I've only watched it once when it came out, and that was like 2001. So... You know, 12 years ago, my memory is far too terrible for that.
It's strange.
Yeah, well, Ang Lee is definitely an interesting choice for that. And that's the end of our question of the week segment. We're not actually going to have another question of the week for next episode because of the live show, you know. We are going to have a live question of the week thing with the audience. And I maybe want to keep that question a secret, not because, you know, it's particularly... too interesting to talk about. It's just that, you know, I want to keep that experience in the live setting. And, you know, that's my rationale. Maybe I didn't think of a question yet. Maybe I'm just playing games. I don't know. You have to work that out for yourself. But yeah, that's our discussion of superheroes, and that's pretty much the show. I mean, slightly different show. I think we're saving our energy for the 100th episode, our live episode.
I'll be there.
Obviously, are you going to be there?
Yeah.
Cool, awesome. In the crowd, just kicking back with a beer.
Assuming I beat this.
I'm fairly sure you're not going to die.
By next week, I'll be all right.
You'll be fine. Obviously, yes, I should mention again that there is the 100th episode live show that is next Wednesday. So that's August the 14th. So if you're in Melbourne, come down. We've got a post up on the Young Australian Skeptic site, youngausskeptics.com. All the details are there. It's got Lawrence Lung. It's going to be amazing. If you can't come because you're underage, unfortunately, it's in a pub and you probably can't go unless, I don't know, there's some, like if you're with your family and ordering a meal, there's probably some way to do it. But I don't want to make guarantees. But if you're not in the country or you're not in the state, then we'll record it just like any other episode and you can listen to it. But there's something to be said for being in the room for a live podcast recording. You get to see what we look like. I assure you, we're not hideously unattractive.
Who's going to be there?
Everybody. Just every single person. It's me, Tom, Belinda, Rachel, Sarah,
right,
and Lawrence Lung. It's going to be great. I hope to see everybody there who can make it. Another thing I have to promote, obviously, is that it's Science Week coming up very soon. I think it starts on the 10th and finishes on the 18th of August in Australia. It's all throughout the country, you know, National Science Week, national being the word. You can go to scienceweek.net.au to find out all these fascinating events that are happening. There's heaps of stuff going on. And one that I particularly want to mention, because I'm involved, is the live recording of the Splendid Chaps podcast. So I've mentioned this a couple of weeks in a row, but on the 11th of August on the Sunday at 5 p.m., there is a live show that's a continuation of a series of live shows about Doctor Who that's been happening every month this year. And the reason that this is particularly relevant to this show, one, because I'm on it, but, you know, I don't want to promote myself too much, but also it's about Doctor Who and science because it's in Science Week. And that's been put on by our good friend Ben McKenzie, who's been on this show before to talk about Doctor Who and science. And that'll also be recorded. It'll be up online if you can't come, but it'll be really fun if you do go. You can go to splendidchaps.com to find out heaps of details about that. We'll be talking about Doctor Who, science, Paul McGann. It's basically a triple win in my books. So that's pretty much the end of the show. We've just got some housekeeping to do. And because I'm the only sort of proper host, I'll just whip through it. I don't want to burden Ted with anything else because I think he's just about to collapse. He's got a vacant look in his eyes. He's bleeding.
Oh, I've got work to do.
All right. I need to call an ambulance.
All right, we'll see. It's all right. We can stop there.
Yeah, he's not dead yet. He's still putting up a fight. If you want to support the show, you can check out the Skeptical Blog Anthology, which is a collection of online articles and essays by heaps of people in the skeptical community. You can go to lulu.com, get it in paperback or in an ebook digital copy, edited by a good friend, Kylie Sturgis of the Token Skeptic podcast. It's great. Help support the show. Great. Do it. I'm giving the thumbs up. Also, if you want to go to iTunes and give us a rating and or a review, that really helps, I don't know, spread the word about the show. Lots of people look at iTunes reviews, and whether or not they're going to download a podcast, that they take that into consideration.
Only if the review is good. If it's not, you can send it to me with your name and address.
Don't threaten people. Don't threaten threats that you can't you can't actually do, because I think you're probably going to collapse 5 minutes after this podcast.
Okay, great.
But if you'd like more people to listen to this show because you enjoy it, then iTunes reviews is the way to go. You might boost us up the charts. We might get some exposure. I don't know. It's just going to help our general thing that we're doing. If you want to contact us, there's various ways to do that. We've got Facebook. As I said last week, we finally fixed the Facebook page for the pseudoscientists. So it's all one word, the space. Obviously, there's a space between the and pseudoscientists. But now it's the pseudoscientists, all one word for pseudoscientists. Awesome. There's also the Young Australian Skeptics if you want to follow our blog on Facebook as well. On Twitter, we're Young AUS Skeptic and PseudoSciPod. And our email address is youngausskeptics@gmail.com. We love getting email from people and you know, we sometimes read it out on the show. It always warms our hearts when someone sends in email about how much they love the show, or if they're listening to it in an interesting foreign country, like I'd love to hear from someone from Sweden, because I just love Sweden so much. Please, if you're a Swedish listener, let us know, because I will hug you through the electronic mail system. We're also on Twitter. I'm Jack L. Scanlon. Tom, who isn't here, is Lang E.M. Hi. Rachel, who isn't here, is Rachel M.K. Belinda, who isn't here, is Oztronomer. And Shelley Siegel, who was on the episode earlier, is Shelley Siegel on Twitter. And Ted, you don't really have a proper Twitter account for yourself.
I'm not using one now, but getting back to the order of business, at Balaclava, BALACLAVA, Junct, JUNCT, or tedjanet.com/balaclavajunction.
Yeah, that's where people can find out details about the stuff that you're doing with that. And as soon as this, pretty much before the episode goes up or as it's going up, the crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo will be going on.
We will be live.
Awesome. So we'll definitely have a link in the show notes for this episode if you want to check that out and chuck a few bucks their way. They'd be much appreciated. And there's heaps of cool prizes and not prizes, rewards, whatever it is. You get stuff out of it. You don't just throw money
at it. Our gratitude is expressed in many, many ways.
Monetary ways. And you don't get money for throwing
money
at it.
I said many ways.
I know. I said monetary and I apologize profusely.
Well, we do have to produce the rewards.
Yeah, true. It does cost money to do sometimes. As always, our intro and outro music is Jawlistics with their track Glorious Feeling. Thanks heaps, Ted, for coming on the show. And in your adult state, I really appreciate it.
This was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Well, see you next week for the 100th live episode. If anyone is coming along, see you there.
Shalom.
The graphic novel, or the is it a comic or a graphic novel?
I'm calling it a graphic anthology because it's not really a novel. Okay. But then again, sure. That sounds, you know, persistently masturbatory. So I don't know. I'm calling it fantastic, and we'll take it from there. I'm calling it holy. This is, it goes
sacred text.
Yeah, it's going to be revelatory. You need to buy 100 copies and then put them in a scroll. and put them on a shrine and then paint me and kneel. That's what you have to do.
Fair enough.